brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT.
Hi, I'm Kevin Davis. Thanks for tuning into our On SOA podcast. Today I'm talking with Priscilla Walmsley, co-author of the book Web Service Contract Design and Versioning for SOA. Priscilla runs her own consulting business called Datypic, where she advises organizations on how to design XML. She's also a member of the W3C XML Schema Working Group. And today we're going to be talking with her about XML schema design. Priscilla, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I understand that you contributed a significant amount of material to this book.
I mostly focused on the schema aspect of it. So there are four chapters in the book on XML schema, and those are the ones that I mostly focused on. And that's a lot of what I do in my business is designing, helping people design schemas for use in service-oriented architectures and, elsewhere.
So how do XML schemas fit in? How does design of an XML schema fit into a service-oriented architecture? I mean, I know when you have when you're creating a service-oriented architecture, one of the key components is schema design. Why is that important?
Yeah, well, schemas are really central to a service-oriented architecture. They describe what the structure and content of the messages that you're passing back and forth are. And, in your schema, you can define all of the elements and attributes. You can say what order they might appear in, what kind of data they contain. And the main purpose that people mostly associate with schemas is validation. So you can take a document and see if it's valid according to a schema when it's, either during the testing or debugging phases of your project or in production. But actually, that's just one of the purposes of schemas in an SOA environment. And really, one of the more important purposes is that it serves as a contract between the two parties who are going to be exchanging this information. It's an enforceable, machine-enforceable set of rules for what the data must look like. And it also serves as documentation. People kind of joke that XML is supposedly human-readable, and it's not really all that human-readable, and schemas especially tend to be a little complicated. But they do serve as a form of documentation, and you can actually generate more human-readable documentation from your schema. So some of the tools out there, the XML editing tools out there, will let you generate documentation. And that's a nice way of, automatically providing a lot more information about what kind of messages you're passing. And then the other use for schemas in an SOA environment is also very important. It's generating code from your schemas. So a lot of times you'll be using some sort of data binding tool that will turn the types and elements and types that you define in your schema into, for example, Java classes. And so to make it easier to process those messages. And so the schemas become very important in that case. So that's one of the first things I like to get across to people is that, when you're designing your schemas, you kind of have to take all of these uses into account, the validation, the documentation, and also the code generation.
That's an incredible amount of responsibility to be placing in one specific part of the design. How detailed does that typically have to be before you can really start development? Do you have to really nail the schema down before anything can happen if you're working on creating services?
Well, I think it is best to get it to nail down to a certain degree, to have sort of a framework in place for how you're going to develop your schemas, have some naming standards and some idea of what the general design of the schema is going to be. If later you need to, add and remove certain elements from your schema, for example, that's not a huge deal. But I think, I'm a big believer in the whole WSDL first approach, which also implies schema first. And that means that really should be, designing your messages should really be the first thing you do.
So it sounds like it might be more difficult to change if you design your schemas first and you're using a code generation tool. You basically have defined the interfaces, but now when you go back, you've put some behavior in your classes, let's say, that have been generated from the schema, how easy is it? How, you know, from a tool support perspective, how easy is it to regenerate those classes? Or is it a generate once, and then if you add it to the schema, you have to manually add it to classes? What's the level of tool support there?
Yeah, it really varies from tool to tool. Some of them, you know, what you're generating are interfaces, and then you're writing application-specific functionality in a different set of classes. So you're a little bit removed from that, although you still would need to make some changes. But regenerating isn't going to wipe out everything you did. But it really kind of varies from tool to tool.
The one thing that I think of when I think of an XML schema, typically I think of more of a data structure design. You know, I'm really sort of designing a data entity, something that lives and not necessarily have behavior, but you sort of describe it as defining an interface, so which more is always speaks to me more of behavior, not of data. Is there any problems describing things that way?
I mean, I think your message, you know, in a way is behavior. I mean, there's a little bit of both. There's data in there, and there's also information about what you want to do with that data. So I think it's a little different from traditional data design.
So when you're creating a service interface, would there be different naming conventions for the things you want the service to do versus the types of information that you're passing along? You know, there's with a service interface, you really often want it to do something. And so there's, I would say, more verb-like behavior. And then the data that you carry around is more noun-like. Is there a different set of things that you would do to describe the data? Do the noun-type schemas or the data containers, do those typically get hosted elsewhere and included in your more interface-like schemas? Or am I thinking about this the wrong way?
No, that's definitely true. I think that one of the most important things about designing schemas in an SOA environment is allowing for reuse. And I think a lot of times you tend to reuse the schemas that represent the data. So you might have one concept of what a purchase order looks like or what, you know, an item on an order looks like. And those things tend to be very reusable, whereas you might have other schemas that are more oriented toward the verb, as you put it, the service activity that you want to perform. And a lot of times people do tend to separate those and include them as necessary, and the data ones become very reusable. Some large organizations have, you know, an enterprise data model that they is basically a diagram or a model of what the data in their entire organization looks like. And when you're designing services, you would be touching on certain parts of that data. So one scenario I've seen is where people develop an entire set of schemas that represent the data of their organization and then pick and choose pieces of those schemas to include in certain, WSDL-related schemas that are more action-oriented.
So do you have any advice on the level of granularity that you would put into a schema? Does for one schema document, is that usually one entity? And then it would sort of include a call out to another schema document that's included? Or do you typically have one large schema document that's, you know, sort of reference for each set of activities? What's the best grouping there?
Yeah, I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages. I mean, if you have one huge schema, in some ways it's easier to manage, but the problem is that it's not as reusable. I mean, if you want to reuse that schema, you have to reuse everything in it, which can lead to, you know, a lot of extra complexity. Whereas if you have lots of tiny schemas, then you're going to end up, they get a little bit hard to manage, and you have includes and includes and includes, and from a development and maintenance perspective, it becomes challenging. So generally, I recommend, first of all, having one schema or a few, you know, a handful of schemas that are common components that you want to use across all services that are really basic things like addresses and units of measure and things like that. And then also have schemas for different subject areas. And that may be an entire application within your organization, or it might be just a subset of an application. But, you know, maybe like, I don't know, it's hard to put a number on it, but maybe like 20 to 30 or 40 different types in a schema. I find that that size is enough, it's good enough for reuse. It's small enough to be reusable, but it's not so small that you're having this, maintenance problem.
So typically what you'd want is your more common, frequently reused types that are more, say, stable. Because I guess versioning probably comes into play here, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, that's the other thing about breaking up schemas is you probably want ones that are versioned together to be in the same schema document, or at least you don't want two things in the same schema document that you want to version separately. So one thing that sometimes changes frequently is code lists. Like if you have a list of product types and you have an enumeration in your schema that lists all the product types, if that changes a lot, then, well, first of all, if it changes all the time, then it might not even be worth using the schema to validate it. But if you do decide to put it in a schema, you might want to have it separate so that you can version it separately.
I think that's a very tricky, what you just said about having things, the data that changes frequently, you might not want in your schema validation. If you lock down a schema really hard, that is to say you put a lot of validation in, you put a lot of strong typing in, it can cause problems, either in the development or the production phase, especially if you're dealing with a lot of customers. Is there any guidance around how tightly to lock down schemas? The schema, you were on the W3C schema working group. Schemas offer you a lot of different types of validation, right?
Right. Right. I mean, I think there's two questions there, actually. One is the how strict to make your schemas, and the other is, the question of interoperability of schemas. So I'll try to answer them both. On the flexibility versus restrictiveness issue, I mean, I think it definitely depends on your application. And if you're writing, a banking application, for example, you don't want a lot of extra elements in there that you didn't expect. But you can use your application code to validate the data also instead of just the schema. And there are a lot of things that the schema can't even if you wanted to make your schemas very strict, there are certain, business rules that can't be expressed in a schema. So I think what a lot of people do is there's no rule saying you can't have two sets of schemas. One is the really strict kind that you use maybe during the development and debugging phase just to make sure that you're getting data that you'd expect, and it's kind of an easy way to just quickly check the interfaces. But in production, depending on how much you trust the systems you're interfacing with, you may just use entirely application code to validate. But there are different, like you said, there are different ways of creating restrictiveness. One question I get a lot is, how specific should my element names be? So, for example, if I'm, the example we use in the book is electronic games. If I have an electronic game and I have a bunch of properties about that, what's the target age range and what's the rating on it and how many players does it expect? Do I create a specific element for each one of those and make it either, required or optional? Or do I have a generic kind of property element that's just stores generically kind of information about that electronic game? And in that particular case, there's a lot of advantage of being flexible, and that way when, new technology is always changing, so when new product properties come along, you don't have to go through a major schema rewrite to add a new feature that might apply to a new product. But on the other hand, if you're too flexible, if you write a schema that just allows almost anything, then you're not really getting the benefits of schemas, which is documentation and being able to generate code that is specific, and you lose a lot of expressiveness in the schema.
I suppose that has something to do with how easily you can do that versioning. It's one thing to put out version one of an interface, which is, essentially your schema document provides a fairly restrictive interface, or can, as you said. But what you end up with if you go too restrictive is it every little change has to come back and become a new version. If you have a lot of new customers coming on or very rapidly changing environment, you have to deal with that somehow. But as you say, with the extremely flexible, if you just had a property definition, then people could censor anything. It would put the onus on your application. But that's an interesting question. If I'm doing validation at the schema level and also have to do validation at the application level, does that violate the single responsibility principle at all? I mean, are you really pushing different types of validation in different layers, or is it the same type of validation and you're splitting it across layers?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, I hear people talk about business rules all the time, and I guess there is a formal definition of what a business rule is, but what people in the XML world tend to call business rules are, you know, anything that can't be expressed in XML schema, which, you know, there are a lot of things like you can't say, you know, if this element contains X, then this other element has to appear, or, you know, things that make require dependencies across elements or attributes. And so I see a lot of times people using schemas to express as much as they can and then taking everything else, all these business rules, and using their applications to validate those. I guess you are spreading the responsibility around. But the other thing you can do, you know, as I mentioned, is have a fairly flexible XML schema in production and then use your application to do most of the validation. Either way, if your model changes a lot, even if you make your model pretty your schema model pretty flexible, you're going to end up having to change your application when your content changes.
True. So one of the other things that comes up frequently for me with XML schema is that typically with a service, I have to use XML, which is typically a hierarchical representation of data, to map to the relational data that's, you know, kept in some backing data store or just, you know, the application objects that I'm dealing with. How do you sort of rationalize that impedance mismatch between XML and relational data?
Yeah, it's a struggle. I mean, I come from a relational database background also before I was introduced to XML, and I have this idea of how things should be structured, and sometimes XML, you know, makes my brain hurt. But I think that one thing that's important to think about is that when you're talking about an SOA environment, these XML documents are temporary. They're not supposed to be the standard representation of that data. So that makes things a little bit easier. It's basically a temporary view on the data. So if you, for example, one thing that is hard to represent is just simple relationships. I mean, you certainly can represent that in XML using identifiers, IDs and ID refs, or keys and key refs in your schema. But the other way to do it is to just redundantly store information. So if I have to, for example, if someone, there's a purchase order where someone orders a product twice, maybe in two different colors or something, if I have to repeat all the product specs for that product twice in my same XML document, it's not really that big a deal because it is a temporary structure for that data.
And typically automatically generated, right? It's not somebody, you know, wasting time filling something out twice. If it's repeated, it's repeated.
Exactly, and it's not prone to error for that reason, too. Yeah.
Priscilla, I want to thank you for talking with us today. That's all the time we have. Priscilla Walmsley is the co-author of the Web Service Contract Design and Versioning for SOA book, available at all major retailers. Priscilla, thank you so much for speaking with us, and I hope to speak with you again soon.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
This episode was brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at InformIT. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or check us out at informit.com/onsoa.